Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry, because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
We work. Now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
African Americans post-emancipation were settling down in Houston in the what was known as the Fourth Ward, which is west of Houston's downtown area. My project was a study of African-American church architecture. Several of the people that I conducted oral interviews with kept referring me back to the Texas room of the HMRC. The HMRC was quite useful in terms of providing information on what life was like for African Americans post-emancipation. And I was able to obtain pictures of what life was like back then, as well as in the early 19th century. We had doctors, we had dentists, we had religious leaders who were also professionals. We had teachers, a lot of teachers, male and female.
One prominent resident of Freedmanstown was Reverend Jack Yates.
He was a symbol of progress. This is someone who didn't have much to begin with, former slave, learned how to read, and he became a leader in the church. In 1891, in particular, he opened up Bethel Missionary Baptist Church in Freedmanstown. That church became an architectural symbol. It was one of the most significant pieces of architecture that later developed.
Freedmanstown was almost a city within a city, with its own business district and social structure, as Crystal Granger discovered when doing her research at the HMRC.
The Red Book of Houston by Emmett Scott is a collection of information, images of what life was like for African Americans post-emancipation. You can find out about the professions, the social histories, who the leaders were in the community, and basically just how the community developed and was a resource for other individuals who were coming from neighboring plantations. Also, in particular in Freedmanstown, there was a main street, Andrews Street, where you would find a lot of these professions. So everyone lived on this main street where a trolley ran through. So the development of Freedmanstown was somewhat of a model for developing a community in post-emancipation. City directories provided information on the individuals who lived in Houston. It stated their race, it stated where they lived, what kind of business they owned, and there were advertisements in the directories that gave you some insight about the business and their location.
A perfect example is a page in the 1886-87 directory, which lists people with these occupations: a railroad switchman, a clerk at Foley's Dry Goods Store, a sheet iron worker, a cotton clerk, a laborer, a teacher, a barber, and so on. The letter C in parentheses indicates that the person was colored or African American.
A lot of Houston's African American history is just fading away, and it was very important for me to try and get a glimpse of what life was like at that time.
The Fourth Ward's historic Bethel Baptist Church was heavily damaged by fire in 2005.
Today's March 1st, 2022, and we got a little spillover from last month. Last month, February 2022, we did a whole month series on slave entrepreneurs and Black Towns History Month and slave artisanomics. Well, I had a convo this morning with a friend of mine that, you know, we went to high school together. And he was coming from, in my opinion, the victimhood side of things, but I'm coming from the glasses half full side of things. Thus, the podcast that we were going to have today, I moved that to tomorrow, and the podcast that we're having right now, the live stream we're having right now, was inspired by a conversation I had probably less than an hour ago. Today's podcast is titled Friedman's Wealth Metrics and Friedmanomics. And let's go back to Wikipedia, which we've been doing for the last month. Let's look up what a Friedman was, because for some reason, once again, this is why I do not watch slave movies. Because if that's all you've seen, man, come on. All right, Friedman's. A Friedman, spelled F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N or M-E-N, a Friedman or freedwoman is a formerly enslaved person who has been released from slavery, usually by legal means. Now, we ran over this definition last month also, but I felt the need to bring it back because I had hit it from a different context. Historically, enslaved people were freed by manumissions, granted freedom by their captors, owners, and they had, once again, that's why I'm saying reparations has already taken place in many different ways. Okay. Granted freedom from their captors, emancipation granted freedom as part of a larger group, or self-purchase. A lot of slaves freed themselves through self-purchase. They worked, they got paid, they saved enough money to purchase themselves freedom. Now today, once again, the podcast is titled Friedman's Wealth Metrics and Freedomnomics. All right. The topics that we're going to cover today, just briefly, I just want to make sure, and this is in the program notes and our scrolling marquee, is 43,560 square feet. Natural Resources Millionaires, Sarah Rector, Friedman Ranchers, Moses Wright, and Black Wall Street, Real Wealth. Okay, now, and I should say, I'm going to correct this right now, with Black Wall Street's Real Wealth Metrics. Okay. All right, I just updated that. All right, now, let's start with many slaves. Not all. I think there were, and I read this stat last week, it was a little bit short of 4 million. At the height of slavery, whatever, there was like 3,900,000+. I'm just rounded up to 4 million black folk here in the United States. Okay, 0.10% were free. There were more than that were free. But 0.10% of that later became not only free, but they became slave masters themselves. That's 4,000 people. I don't care what you say, 4,000 people. Now, it's all relative to what? Well, 4,000 people is a lot of people, although it was less than 1% of the 4 million. But even today, shit, everybody's not walking around a millionaire. Okay. Now, many freedmen, okay, or freed women that became wealthy or started their own towns were, they owned land, owned it by the acre. Okay. Now, an acre then, as well as now, on March 1st, 2022, and this is basic people, because I want some of you people, you got to come, get rid of this white supremacy mindset, man. An acre is 43,560 square feet. You can fact check me online or wherever. I'll call you a math teacher or math professor or whatever. An acre is 43,560 square feet. Now, you've got to see the beauty and the wealth and the power of 1 acre of land. Once again, an acre is 43,560 square feet. That's a lot of square footage. Now, within that acre are natural resources. Natural resources. So, depending on the acre, you could have 43,560 acres worth of trees. One of the byproducts of trees is you can make lumber. You can exchange that byproduct of lumber for anything you want, including government-issued legal tender. That's just one of your options. It's not the only option. It's just one of your options. Even if you don't have trees on the property, you typically have 43,560 square feet of vegetation. Or let's say you got a mixture of trees and vegetation on there, and, you know, it's the fall of the year, and there are dead leaves on the ground, and there's tree branches on the ground, and that type thing. You got 43,350 acres, 43,568 square feet on that 1 acre that you can make biofuels with. You can take those biofuels and you can exchange them for dollars or pesos or euro or rubles or whatever you want. And that's wealth, man. So a lot of these freedmen purchase land. You take well, let's even break this down even simpler. Sarah Rector, who I've mentioned on here several times, Sarah Rector had, at 12 years old or whatever age she was at the time, she had at least 80, she had anywhere from 80 to 160 acres worth of land. Let's put it at 80 acres. Okay, and they said it was 80 acres it wasn't good for farming. But she still had 80 acres of natural resources. Now, I want you to look up the word natural resources and then also put into the search engine the different types of natural resources or the distinctions of natural resources. So she had, let's say she had 80 acres of land. She probably had more than that, but she had at least 80 acres of land. 80 acres, let's do the arithmetic again, times 43,560 square feet. She had 3,484,800 square feet of land, which had, was just full of natural resources. She monetized just one of those resources, oil, and got rich. Now, let me correct that. She got richer, because if you got 80 acres of land, which is over 3 million square feet of natural resources, you're already rich. Point blank, you're rich in natural resources. But she took one of those natural resources, which was oil, changed it for dollars. And see, once the so many of us had to be validated by government. Because really, government-issued legal tender is really a glorified food stamp. That's the way I look at it. All right? Now, in 2022, that they might have 1 acre of land, and there's no oil in the ground, but there's still natural resources on it. Here's a perfect example. If you got 1 acre of land, which is 43,560 square feet, and the sun is up, there's daylight, you've got 43,560 square feet of sunlight, which is a natural resource, shining on that property. Put some solar panels out there, you can harness that. You have dairy farmers in various parts of the world who have done that. They're making more money by putting solar panels on their land than they're making from dairy farming. We'll do a podcast on there one day. We'll probably even do a field trip. So a lot of these freedmen, former slaves, all black, a lot of these freedmen and freed women, they purchased land. If you look at a lot, if you do some research on a lot of the people that were lynched during the Jim Crow era or wherever, most of those people were wealthy landowners. Not all of them, but quite a few. When I first started It's My House, we interviewed the granddaughter or great-granddaughter of one of them. I'm trying to get her back. Her great-grandfather owned, or great-great-grandfather had 500 or 600 acres of land. Just use the 500 acres. 500 acres times 43,560 square feet. He had 21,780 square feet worth of natural resources. That's a wealthy person, and I would even say a very wealthy person. He developed it. He had a homestead on there. He put a school on there. And he would typically go into town, you know, a couple of bodyguards. The one time that he went into town without an escort, with no bodyguards, he got jumped, killed. They went back to the farm, where he had this homestead set up on the 500 acres, and said, "We just killed your whatever, and if you don't get out by sundown," and a lot of this happened. That's why they had the whole thing on sundown dams. We're gonna do the same thing to you. And you had a whole bunch of black folks that walked away from thousands of acres of land in such fashion. So his family, out of fear, walked away from 21,780,000 square feet promised land. But I can't blame him. I probably would have did the same thing. Health and safety first. And I'll go get another. There's more acres around. There's wherever you go, you can start all over and start fresh. So you had freedmen who became ranchers. One of them, he grew up in a ranching family, was Joseph Jake Simmons Jr. There are books, at least one or two books written by him. Now, I know his family at one time had like 1,000 acres of land. He was an oil tycoon, too, just like, Sarah Rector. I think his family had 1,000 acres of land. Once again, let's do the math. 1,000 acres times 543,560. His family had at least 43,560 square feet of natural resources. That's a rich person or a rich family. I don't care how you slice the cake. That's what we titled this program today, Freedmen's Wealth Metrics. He was an oilman. He was a rancher. And when you throw in the rancher metric, you know, you got other metrics in there, animals, cows, horses, you know, that all these different type of metrics go into that. Water. Under that 43,560 square feet of land was groundwater. I don't know if they sold bottled water back then, but, well, put it this way, they do now. I'm on a well. I'm just on a little bit of a quarter acre where I'm at right now, and I don't purchase water unless I'm out somewhere. And really, I should be carrying my water with me. To be honest about it, I should be ashamed of myself for even buying water. Every time I leave out here, I should be carrying my own bottle of water with me. And I think I'm going to make that a new habit of mine. But most of these free, a lot of these freedmen, not all of them, but many of them, that they thought that way, okay, in terms of their metrics. Because some people, their metrics is that EBT card. All right, if that's where you're at, that's where you're at. No judgment. I mean, that's you're sure. Some of you, your wealth metric is based on, you know, the dollar bill or the ruble or the peso or whatever currency you're dealing with. You know, that's your metric. Some people, their wealth metric is based on, you know, trinkets, you know, cars, watches, clothes. That's your metric. In other parts of the world, you know, if you're part of the Maasai tribe in East Africa, your wealth metric might be, you know, goats, you know, cows, you know, how much land you got, you know, what do you have on that land? What are the natural resources? So, you know, but some people, it's family. You know, like in the Latin American community, you know, they judge wealth by, you know, how many kids do you have? In some parts of Asia, you know, how many branches, which is children, have you had? How many branches have you added to the family tree? That's their wealth metric. I mean, looking back at it, children, particularly if you're right with the right person, that's a, in my opinion, an excellent way to measure wealth. So, you know, there are many different ways to measure wealth. Now, this another person I want to talk about, Moses Wright. Moses Wright was the uncle of Emmett Till. And let me give you my version of the Emmett Till story. I've said it only a few times, but I'm going to put it out here again. I'm going to give you my wealth metrics on it. In my opinion, through my investigations, Till was not the intended target of that whole thing that went down when he lost his life. He was only there 5 days when he got abducted and killed. The intended target, in my opinion, and I'm open for if you want to have some debate on this, 619-768-2945. The intended target was really Moses Wright, his uncle. My theory is that they were trying to figure out a way on how to get at Moses Wright. Now, why would they want to be at the Moses Wright? Why couldn't they get at him? Well, he was a preacher down there. He had a considerable amount of social capital. He was liked in the community. And the wealth metric that he had is, and he was a sharecropper, which I call a contract farmer. He had control, 25 acres of land. All right, now let's do the wealth metrics arithmetic on this. 25 acres of land times, give me that number again, 43,560. So Moses Wright was in control of 1,089,000 square feet of land. I'm considering Moses Wright a millionaire based on the natural resource of that wealth metric of land. One of the byproducts, which is a natural resource on that 25 acres, which was 1,089,000 square feet, was the cash crop of cotton. My theory says that the abduction and the killing of Emmett Till, who had only been there for 5 days, Emmett Till was used as a ruse, because the ruse that typically people got behind was he disrespected a white woman by sexualizing her, by whistling at her. They used that as the ruse to kill him, thinking that, just like they did with the Sundown Towns, that Moses Wright's family would leave. Well, his wife left first, then his two sons left after that. Moses Wright stuck around for the trial, but right after the trial, he left the state of he left Money, Mississippi, and he left behind 25 acres, or he left behind 1,089,000 square feet of cotton ready to harvest. Now, what nobody ever talks about is who took possession of that 1,089,000 square feet of cotton. Somebody did, and somebody made money from it. Nobody talks about that angle of it. Now, let's link this to Black Wall Street. Black Wall Street was a neighborhood within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was 40 acres of land. 40 acres of land, let's do it again, people, is 43,560 square feet. All right, total, Black Wall Street was made up of 1,742,400 square feet. Okay, O.W. Gurley was the one that he purchased that 40 acres, or 1,742,400 square feet. He platted it out, he sold it to people, and it became known as Greenwood. We call it today Black Wall Street. Now, the same thing with Emmett Till, because, you know, people were land grabbing. The same ruse that was used with Emmett Till, saying that he whistled at a white woman, happened with Black Wall Street. Actually, it happened with Black Wall Street first. The elephant, and I got to get Laurel Stratford on here, grandniece or great-great-grandniece of J.D. Stratford. We got to get her on here soon because she can break it down, and she's a blood relative. But the elevator, the rules was this. They said a black dude disrespected or did something sexual to a white female elevator operator. What they don't tell you is those two were dating. They don't tell you that part of the story. But the rules was, you know, he did something sexual that he shouldn't have done to her. And that was the rules, just like with Emmett Till, a black guy said something or did something to offend a white woman. That was the rules that worked over and over and over again. And then they raised the block. Now, what was interesting is, before they raised the block, these people, they were organized. They went in with trucks, and they looted the houses of dresses and trinkets and all that. And then after they looted the house on a particular clock and they drove off to the next block, only after they looted the homes did they destroy, set the blaze. And then after that, you know, after the embers cooled off and all that, all right, they tried to rebuild some of it. But essentially, that's 40 acres or 1,700 come on, phone. 1,742,400 square feet that was taken over by other people because some people didn't come back and try to rebuild. One acre of land, depending on what's on there, and depending on how you can recognize what resources, what natural resources on that land, and then how many byproducts that you can make from those natural resources, 1 acre can make you a millionaire or worth a million. It all depends on your wealth metrics. So a lot of these freedmen and freed women, their wealth metrics I would say study them. I mean, particularly if you got a craft. You know, building bridges, building homes, building ships, growing tomatoes, growing crops, being a farmer, being a gardener. There are many ways. I mean, can you imagine a person who's got I'll give you one that we gave last month. Former slave. And you can, once again, go to Wikipedia. Junius George Groves. Once again, look up, and we covered him last month. Junius George Groves started off life as a slave. He was a farmer. He was a potato farmer. He was a prolific prolific potato farmer. who grew more, and when he was living, grew more potatoes, produced more bushes than any person at that time living on the planet. He became rich by planting acres upon acres upon acres of potatoes. When you get a chance, and that's the wealth metrics I go by now. Natural resources. Now, you have other, I mean, you got other metrics, man. Stocks, bonds, crypto. You know, there's a whole lot of metrics you can go by. But mining some dirt is relatively cheap, particularly on where you buy the dirt. And appreciating the natural resources that are there. I had an uncle, great uncle, we call him Uncle Jose. I never met him. But to this day, you hear his name occasionally in family conversations. And this guy would go out into the woods when there was no Home Depot, Menards, or Lowe's, or Ace, or Lumber 84. He would go out into the woods looking for natural resources, trees in this case, to build a house. Because in our family back then, that's what he did. When somebody was getting married or got married, he would build them a house. And that's how they got started. No mortgage on a house or whatever. His skill set was going out into the woods, recognizing the correct trees to cut down. He would make his own lumber. He had no choice but to make his own lumber. But he had the access to the natural resources of the right trees to do that. And many of his homes are still standing to this day and still occupied to this day. So I'm going to probably have to hook up with somebody and write a little e-book on this, Friedman's Wealth Metrics and Friedmanomics. Because a lot of people, their wealth metric is, in my opinion, just warped. I mean, because somebody has a Maybach sitting in the driveway, all right, if that's the way you measure wealth, okay, great. But I'm getting very fundamental. You know, start with a, it doesn't have to be an acre. But there's a lot of wealth that comes out of that in the form of natural resources. And that's how a lot of freedmen, they got wealthy. That was probably the easiest way to get wealthy. Because once again, 43,560 square feet is a lot of square feet. Some of you that have acres of land right now, just multiply that figure, whatever how many acres you got, times 560 square feet, the beginning. Because what do you have on there? Groundwater. You know, how much rain hits that land a year. You know, when the sun rises, even if it's a cloudy day, you still got over 43,560 square feet of daylight there that can generate energy. Even if you got cows and horses, there's poop everywhere on that 43,560 square feet. Man, you can sell that and make money from that too. And people do it. Okay, we got to take a quick break here. We'll be back. Go to the phone lines.
I say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned. And the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. Couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Now, the wealth metrics in that little piece, first thing, we have time. Okay. 24 hours in a day. And he went off to work, so let's say let's see, how many seconds are in a day? Let's look at that. Seconds, in a day. There are 86,400 seconds in a day. All right. As a matter of fact, let's even break that down. Seconds. Seconds in 1 hour. Okay, we're going through some wealth metrics here. Seconds in an hour. There are 3,600 seconds an hour. All right. So he had 9 friends coming over, or 9 pickup trucks. Let's say he had 2 people in each truck. So let's say he had 18 people. Let's add himself. That's 1. That's 19 people. 19 people and 3,600 seconds in an hour. He just multiplied his seconds to 68,400 seconds. Times, let's say they worked 8 hours. That's 547,200 seconds. Time is an asset. When you add human capital to it. And then within us humans, we have natural resources. Our height is a natural resource. Our intelligence, the thoughts that come out of our head are natural resources. Nineteen people times, let's say, 8 hours. He multiplied from one individual of 8 hours to 152 man hours in that 8 hours of work time, and that's why that house, once again, people, what are your metrics? Time is a metric. You know, Toyota makes or assembles 30 cars per minute. That's their metric. So I talked to somebody last month. This is totally crazy, but I guess this happens a lot. They were in a house. When I talked to them, they were in a shelter. But they had to get into a shelter because they got beat up over an EBT card. But for some people, not judging, for some people, that's their metric. That's their metric. Anyway, they're you know, I guess wealth, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. But in any event, like I said, I might have to probably write a little short e-book on this, Friedman's Wealth Metrics and Freedomnomics. Friedmanomics. In my attempt to help people, expand their awareness of what wealth metrics are. That's not an EBT card. It's just not a dollar bill or a euro or a pound. There's some things that you can easily get hold of if you see the potential of them. In any event, we'll cover this more in the future. So, let's see. 314, your mic is open.
What's going on, L.A.?
Oh, it's Tuesday. No, is it Tuesday? Yeah, it's Tuesday, yeah. No complaints. What about on your end?
Well, you know, there's a lot of opportunities. Take space, for instance. You can become a trillionaire for mining asteroids, being in the deflection business, deflecting asteroids that's on a trajectory to hit the planet Earth, mining water, rare earth materials, or should I say rare minerals, but even them on the planet here has a lot of value to them, providing
right.
Providing supplies to space station, a lot of opportunities in space itself for those that want to take advantage of. Absolutely. And that's going to be the next demand. You know, back in the 1930s when they developed, when they discovered quantum, as in quantum physics. No one knew what to do with the formulation. But now it has become a major component in the application of artificial intelligence. Where would it be without it? And you can think the same along other lines, like Einstein's formula, which has now led to lasers. people, you know, you receive rewards for it. But what are we going to do with this? I don't know. But that's just the way things work. People have things in hand and don't know what to do with it. But through the advent of innovation in mind, those discoveries, inventions, well, not inventions, they really discoveries, they can be applied to innovation that has yet to come.
True.
So there, in fact, is where a lot of trillionaires is going to be made. And for one reason, as you start getting into more complicated stuff, like I tell you, people, you know, educating children. Children should be doing mathematics, going to college to learn the most advanced of mathematics, those that can. That way they can apply what it has to offer in developing future needs.
Right.
Which are going to come.
I agree. I was talking to this friend that inspired this podcast this morning. He was looking at robots. I guess in a more of a negative light, because I said with robots, I said, well, from one hand, if you're an employer or a business owner, I mean, number one, robots don't get sick. They don't call in sick. They don't complain. They don't join unions. They don't strike. None of that. And then
they don't get pregnant,
just with human progress, you know, people learn new skills and go into jobs that haven't even been invented yet. That's just the way things have been rolling from day one. You know, there are no more Pony Express riders out here, not to my knowledge.
You know, you played that one skit about the Mexican rebuilding the house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we've done the same thing, too. On a weekend, we went to, and I thought it was St. Joe, but I think it was St. Andrews, Missouri, and a group of us, you know, that worked together. A friend of mine, Bobby Milton was his name. Matter of fact, it was at his house. Bob Milton was white.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent human being. You know, it was at his house that I met Chuck Berry.
Oh, okay.
Came over his house. There sat Chuck Berry in the living room on the couch. I got a picture of him, but I can't find it.
Is he from St. Louis or Missouri or someplace?
Yeah, he's from St. Louis.
Okay, all right.
And the house he lived in, I think, is in deplorable condition. But Bobby Milton stayed there in Jennings, and I think the street he stayed on was Helen. The house is still there. He'd long been died. But we went out to, a group of us went to St. Andrews. I believe it was St. Andrews. I'm not definitely sure. And we erected a building, finished it. I think it was two weekends, Saturday and Sunday. For Boys and Girls Club. And we got done. They had a brand new building, Boys and Girls Club. It was what you would call a metal building.
Okay.
People fed, had good food. And, you know, that's similar to what you were saying that in your play there about the Mexicans rehabbing a house next door to the man. And it's a group of people that put their mind together and say, this is what we're going to do, want to do, and they do it.
And see, that's what I include in a wealth metric. You know, you guys had social contact. You had, within those social contacts, you had people who had the skill set to, you know, to do what you just said.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people overlook that. For whatever reason, even these shootings up in, Chicago, over streets or corners that they don't own. But their wealth metric is, man, extremely narrow.
Well, they do that stuff. It's terrible. The thing about it, blacks don't seem to pay no attention to it. You know, I don't know what it is about blacks. You know, they can talk about everybody else, but one makes mention about what's going on within their own self-imposed small groups or communities and neighborhoods. They don't want to criticize themselves. The lack of the ability to be critical of oneself is a sign of underdevelopment and really, in some cases, backwards thinking.
Right.
If you can't be critical of your own self, well, who's going to have concern about you more so than anybody else? And you may mention about that, and of course, I make mention about it quite often, that there are plagues and stymies people grow. You know, you said about how blacks often walked away from land. Well, blacks in Ferguson done the same thing during the Mike Brown incident.
Hmm.
When all those riots and looting and stuff was going on in their city. And as people, see, you usually have several ways. You have blacks leave and move into available spots that's practically all white.
Mm-hmm.
Then the whites move, and rightfully so. I don't blame them. I move too. That's why the blacks move from areas, because they didn't want to be associated of or around that type of strife and mayhem that they was experiencing.
Right.
Well, after a few decades, then you have another wave after the residences is just are unlivable for whatever reason. They unlivable. The first responsibility of keeping a residence up is the person who owns it, living in it themselves. That's the first mm-hmm. responsibility. It's not government. It's not the federal government, the White House. It's the people that live in it. And that responsibility can be shared among family members as one would hope that it would be.
Right.
But when they become unlivable, they fall into a state of condemnation, and people have to leave. Where do they go? Well, your politics and wrangling of politics steer them into area where blacks have moved and made a very viable area. Good property value, good schools. They have consumer value additive, like stores, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, here comes the next wave. And they seemingly cannot exist under those type of circumstances. You know, the services that you have in the cities are usually free, but when you go out in your county area, you got to pay for that yourself. You got to
right.
pay for your water.
You
got to pay for your trash pickup. Absolutely. And you got good schools. But when you start moving others into that, in this case, in Ferguson, with blacks coming out of the city, did things ever change? So guess what those people have done? Just like you was talking about and what you was made mention, they left. Well, they did the same thing. They had to leave. They couldn't no way they were going to get the value of their property that they had put into it over the decades. They had to leave.
Right.
And then the process starts over again. They move outward away. They move into what has been majority, vastly white area. Now, it's a funny thing in the St. Louis area. You got an exodus from St. Louis. You got an exodus from, guess where? Kansas City, Missouri. From St. Louis West, from Kansas City East.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine someday they'd meet up in the middle of someplace. But
yeah.
then when they take those areas where they left in the city and developers come in and do development based on some carefully planned studies and designs and plans, like I say, and they get investors. Investors want to know what's going on. How are we going to get our money back?
Right.
So they gentrify. Investors fuel gentrification. And if it seems possible that it's going to be viable and profitable, they get involved. But then you got those naysayers say, well, they're running this out of the community. Well, if you stand in a community that's not producing a tax base in order to support the services and needs of the city in the form of taxes, in the form of supporting a public school system, that's why public schools are going to go by the wayside. I wouldn't send my child to one of the government schools either.
Right.
Then guess what? They got to do something with it. If not, it's going to stay a desolate area. So they regentrify. And the people that's there got to leave. If they didn't leave, or should I say, if you left them there, how would they be able to take care of what's brand new when they couldn't take care of what was old?
Right.
Do you see of any other way?
You're right. The things that you're bringing up, a lot of people just don't think about them. I mean, look, for instance, stated, which you were very accurate, the investors through gentrification, well, the people that were living in those neighborhoods, and you do have people out there, they're all white neighborhoods that get gentrified too. So people that live in those neighborhoods, you know, it can start, here's a simple investment. Pick up the trash. That's a simple investment. Start with picking up the trash. But a lot of people that live in a neighborhood don't want to do that. So the next group of people, as their investment is, typically is to clean up the neighborhood, just picking up the trash. Simple investment.
Well, I was talking to a young man today, early this morning, 34 years old. And he went to Philadelphia to visit somebody that we talked to periodically. And he said he's driving through an area in Philadelphia, he never seen so much trash on the street in all of his life.
Mm-hmm.
That city is ran by black government. And like you say, yeah, they regentrify white areas too because the same thing rule applies. Well, my goodness, can't you pick up the trash? Trash cans on the street, 5 feet. Water, walk over there and throw it. No, I throw it in the street. Come to the stop sign. You got to open the door, set your can, beer can or whatever, there on the yellow line, then drive off, leaving it there. So it's just really ridiculous. Heck, down there in New Orleans, people don't even stop at stop lines for fear of being carjacked.
Oh, yeah, you can't blame them. you got some young, crazy people out here, 11, 12 years old, carjacking senior citizens.
They had one case at Costa, we read about. I think I sent you that article. White woman, gassing up her car, here comes some hoodie, going to jump in, try to take the car. She's going to try to stop it. She get dragged. She get hurt, laying there on the drive. A Indian doctor that was behind her sees her laying there, so she run to assist in medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hell, the guy behind her, black guy, holler, can you move your car so I can leave?
And I'm thinking those people that carjack, those people have a warped, wealth metric. That they got to go take somebody else's stuff, and then I don't know what they get for it, if anything at all. Then they got to look over their shoulders. Half of them get caught probably. And then a little
jealous
money that
they
get.
See others there. Yeah, then folks come up with all these damn reasons, excuses why they're acting like that. I don't know. Maybe they're aliens. I don't know. They're crazy. Something's wrong with them. But here's the point. I don't have to live around, shouldn't be made to live around that kind of mess, because you don't have time to tend to that. You got your own problems. You got your own kids, your own life that you have to tend to.
Right.
And they give churches tax-exempt status, whereas people give to churches and other organizations to take care of that. But that does not ever happen. It just gets worse and worse and worse. I don't know what to say. I believe these people are cursed. I keep telling you that. But another point, too, when you're poor, it's your children should be well-educated and give them skills that they need so that they can apply those skills and be able to compete. That's the society that you live in today.
I agree.
It's just not your neighbor across the street. You got people from all over the world that's coming to compete. You got
now, a lot of those skills are going to have to be picked up, particularly if you got your kids in public school. It's going to have to be, you're going to have to get them through after-school programs, weekend programs. You know, you're going to have to go outside of that, just depending on everything you're going to get on. Even if it's a private school, like driver's ed, I went to a private school, but driver's ed wasn't offered at my private school. So my mother had to pay for, driver's ed outside of that.
That's part of giving you the tools you need so that you can so that you can maneuver your way in the system environment that you have to survive in. 100% right. And that's not happening. If it's not happening where you are, and that's why I'm for school, that's why I'm for vouchers and school choice. Because no person, no child should be made to sit amongst a lot of others, whereas they are not being educated and prepared functionally. But you do have children that come from deprived and poor situations, and the parents do as much as they possibly can. So they should be awarded with the ability to have access to the next step. You don't want to keep them locked in with just the opposite. That don't make any sense. Why would you waste that? You got people say, well, you can't take your child out because if you do, the overall average of the performance will go down. If you take your child is doing an 80 and everybody else is doing a 20 and 25, well, the average is going to go down. 80 and 20 is 100. So they make an average of 50. Take that 80 out of there and leave all them 20s. You still got a 20. That's going to affect my pay.
Right.
You hear all those arguments? Yeah. But L.A., no matter what it is, you still got to continue to try and try to do the right thing. The cream's going to rise to the top no matter what.
True.
Now, how much it is, I don't know. You know, you talk about what you were talking about this morning, like Sarah Reckner. Sarah Reckner took advantage of the 160 acres that she was allotted by being a Creek Indian. A whole family. If you had four families in a house that was 180, what did I say, 160, 320,
yeah,
140?
Yeah, 80 to 160 acres of land. Each.
That's 640 acres. That's a lot of land. And luckily in the United States, if you got resources on your land, they're yours. Other places in the world, they're not. I sent you the video of the mayhem that's going over in Nigeria where you have the Fulani, the tribesmen. They're coming down and they're creating ethnic genocide, ethnic cleansing, all the way down to central Nigeria in the Plateau State. Just like they've been doing forever.
Ethnic cleansing. You know what? That's a good topic because a lot of your reparations crowd, they don't talk about the ethnic cleansing that went on whenever, three, four, whatever it went on years ago.
It's going on now. They're killing men.
Yeah, and it goes on today, and it's nothing new. That's the point I'm making.
They raping women. You know why they rape the women? Because they plant their seed. That's going to be their future ideology. That's going to be the product of that birth. So they cleanse out the existing culture. They cleanse out the existing tradition. And they bring in their own. Guess what's happening?
That would be great to bring in them elements in a reparations conversation. They don't talk about that side of reparations.
No, Black Lives Matter is not going over there marching and using chants and walking around with signs. Those people would kill them. They're not going to Ukraine either. Those Africans in the Ukraine going to school, they was invited there. The question is, why come you don't have that type of education going on where you come from?
Right.
Why do you have to go abroad? Now, it's nothing unusual for students to go abroad. I mean, if you want to really have some good education from a geologist, you would go to Russia because they do it better than in many other countries because of the environment that they live in. Some of the best geological schools that you could ever attend is in Russia. But also at the same time, those people don't want to amalgamate their society. And you know what I'm talking about. Same thing with Chinese. Nigerian merchants are in China. They are restricted to one area. That's the area of them. They don't want them infiltrating into the greater society because they do not want to amalgamate their society. That's their people's choice. Call it what it is. It's their choice and not some other far-fetched idea or theory. That's their choice. They don't want to amalgamate their community. Go to another planet. Probably have the same thing. I really appreciate the opportunity. I might call you later on. Talk to you about it.
Okay, sure. I'll be here. Okay, everyone have a good rest of the day. We'll be right back.